and I'm very excited to welcome you to the book launch and poetry reading of La Gran Náusea by Xavier Mas Cravioto on behalf of the Bristol Poetry Institute. And I very much hope that you'll enjoy the event. If you're interested in poetry, please do follow the BPI, the Bristol Poetry Institute, on Twitter, because that's where we post all our events and activities, hopefully some online and some in person. And without further ado, I'll just introduce our discussants and, of course, the author. And we're very excited to have with us Xavier Mas Cravioto from Navas in Catalonia, who's currently the Catalan Lector at our HIPLA, Hispanic and Portuguese and Latin American Department at Bristol. He is a graduate in Catalan Philology from University of Barcelona, where he also completed a postgraduate degree in language consultancy and publishing services. He collaborated for 2 years with the Research Center for Sociolinguistics and Communication. He's one of the founders of Como Diria, an online platform focused on the use of slang amongst young Catalan speakers. At 17, he was finalist in the Jordi Sierra Fabra Literary Award in Spain and Latin America. And from then on, he has won around 20 literary awards of narrative and poetry. He has published the novel La Mort Lenta, The Slow Death, in 2019, with which he won the Documenta Award in 2018, and the book of poems, Denise de Cavalcanti Negra, Black Horses Neighs, 2019. I hope I've said that right. awarded with Certamen Adjuva Salvador Iborra Prize. He has participated in several poetry readings and in some collective books of short stories, along with other Catalan authors. So please do join me in giving Xavi a warm welcome. And joining Xavi and facilitating tonight's discussion will be our very own Dr. James Hawkey, who is a senior lecturer in Spanish and Catalan linguistics and is Catalan Studies Coordinator at the University of Bristol. Dr. Rebecca Kosick, who is senior lecturer in translation and co-director of the BPI, who will be reading the English translations of Xavi's poems. And finally, but by no means, sharing the discussion will be Dr. Joanna Crowe, who is associate professor in Latin American Studies and head of subject at the Department of Hispanic Portuguese and Latin American Studies. So again, thank you for coming, and hope you enjoy the event.
Thank you, everybody, for coming. I just wanted to say we're really delighted to have Xavi working with us in the department, and it's great to see some of Xavi's students here as well today. And it's really great to be able to celebrate the launch of his book and be able to celebrate in person as well. So the way it's going to run, Xavi's going to read a couple of his poems, a couple of the poems from the book, and Becky is going to translate them and read an English translation. Then James is going to be asking Xavi some questions, very difficult questions, and then we'll open it up to questions for everybody else, and then we'll close with Xavi reading a couple of other poems from the collection, again, and then if everything goes well, we do have a room booked over there for drinks afterwards. Thank you, everybody, for being here. Over to you.
So, good evening, everyone, and thank you for coming. I'm so excited to be here. Thank you, James, Becky, Joe, and Miguel for setting this up, and also to the Bristol Poetry Institute for having me. I will start reading three poems. The first one is called Autopsia. And it says, potser era l'ull esmolat de l'ocell de la son que ens mirava. Potser era tota aquesta angúnia resseguint-nos la frontera dels països que ens habiten el crostim de cada pell. Potser era l'hàbil silueta de la búlia nuclear que ens eixampla el cansament rere l'escorça del nosaltres. Potser érem tu i jo, que ens enteníem el no-res i el fèiem arbre profanat del paradís de veure'ns caure. Potser era el traç arrodonit que desdibuixo en l'aire brut quan m'estimbo els teus barrancs. Potser eren les dents de l'esvorany que ens acull boca obert a una fi que fa molts anys que coneixem. Potser era la suorrància del món, la narcosi estructural, l'anestèsia vascular, el suport deificat. Potser era el buit estomacal d'aquest déu trist que ja fa temps que s'avorreix i plora runa.
I should say first that James and Xavi, they translated these poems jointly. I'm just giving voice to them, so I can't take credit for it. The translations that are beautiful, but I'll read them. Autopsy. Maybe it was the sharp eye of the bird of sleep that was looking at us. Maybe it was all this anguish traversing the borders of the countries that live within the scab on our skin. Maybe it was the deft outline of the nuclear abulia that fills us with weariness behind the rind of us. Maybe it was you and me, that we understood the nothingness and made of it a profane tree in the paradise of watching us fall. Maybe it was the circular stroke that I draw in the dirty air when I hurl myself into your ravine. Maybe it was the teeth of that rift that welcomes us, open-mouthed, into an end that we've known for many years. Maybe it was the rancid sweat of the world, the structural narcosis, the vascular anesthesia, the saintly drowsiness. Maybe it was the gastric void of this sad god that for some time is bored and cries rubble.
Fractura. Se't vincla. Notes que se't vincla. Se't vincla com la branca on nien els ocells i coven ous. Se't vincla. Notes que se't vincla. Malgrat la fe, malgrat les certeses com filferro resseguint-te la columna vertebral per redreçar-la, malgrat les promeses que eren ombres silencioses apuntalant-te inútilment la medula espinal que ja no es dreça, que s'ha fet seu aquest pes que perillosament l'encorba, que ja és així, vincladís, al seu estat natural. I se't vincla. Cada vèrtebra és una renúncia que t'arqueja esclafant-te sota el pes de cada culpa i se't vincla i se't revincla i se't corba i se't fa aguda la paràbola del cos i de la culpa i t'hi xisclen els pollets la tenença resignada de qui espera la caiguda i se't vincla i t'agonitza la columna que ja sagna sacrifici i et sacseja l'equilibri. Se't vincla i l'esquena ja et dibuixa una arcada perillosament corbada. Se't vincla. I amb cada nova renúncia t'hi xisquen els ocells la temença resignada de qui espera la fractura.
Fracture. It bends, you notice it's bending. It bends like the branch where birds nest and sit on eggs. It bends, you notice it's bending, in spite of faith, in spite of certainties, like wires crossing your spinal column to straighten it. In spite of promises that were silent shadows, uselessly propping up your spinal cord that is no longer straight, that has taken on this weight, that dangerously hunches it now, it that is now like this bendy. Its natural state, and it bends. Each vertebra is a sacrifice that arches you, flattening you under the weight of each guilt, and it bends again, and it twists, and it makes an acute angle of the parabola of your body and your blame, and the chicks shriek at you, the resigned fear of someone who awaits the fall. And it bends, and it hurts your spine that already bleeds sacrifice, and it shakes your core. And it bends, and your back already draws a dangerously hunched arch. It bends, and with each new sacrifice, the birds shriek the resigned fear of someone who awaits the fracture.
La gran nàusea. Contracció del diafragma. I aquell silenci lent que vares dir-me entre el brugit, palpitació del bulb requidi i el tacte indexifrable d'una pell que ja no entenc, regust de fel i salivera i els desordres aberrants que em capgiren l'alfabet, inversa peristalsi i les mans fetes de fusta i de corps indiferents, estómac espasmòdic i els mil noms que té la pena quan la dius durant la nit, borbollets de tot subgàstric i els dits del tedi altiu fent-me un nus a cada verb, el cor regurgitant-se a si mateix i la calma mentidera encubant-se'm dins el pit, ascens sobtat del quim i el buit tenyent-me els ulls amb els colors que fa l'hivern i tot just abans del vòmit, la gran nàusea, la nàusea de no ser-hi quan som l'un arran de l'altre.
The great nausea. Contradiction of the diaphragm and that slow silence that you told me amidst the noise. Palpitation of the medulla oblongata and the indecipherable touch of a skin I no longer understand. Slight taste of bile and salivation, and the aberrant confusions that turn my alphabet upside down. reverse peristalsis and hands made of wood and indifferent woodworm, stomach spasms and the thousands of names that hurt, and the thousand names that hurt has when you say it in the night, bubbling of gastric juices, and the figures of that haughty boredom tying me in a knot with each verb, the body regurgitating itself, and the deceitful calm brooding inside my chest, sudden surge of chime, and the void coloring my eyes with shades of winter, and just before vomiting, the great nausea, the nausea of not being there when one of us is near the other.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you so much, Chavi. It's obviously the first time I've heard you read these poems aloud, and Becky, it's the first time that we've heard these poems read in English, and it's absolutely fantastic to hear, you know, to see all this brought to life. So this is a really, really wonderful, wonderful moment. So I've just got some brief questions. Obviously, as Joe said, they're going to be incredibly difficult. And, we'll make you earn your wine at the end. So this one is obviously incredibly tough. But just the origin of the book generally, you know, what inspired it, and I suppose more broadly, what inspires you?
It's a tough question already, because sometimes I have the feeling when I'm writing something that the things I write don't have a clear origin sometimes, because I feel you keep living and you keep receiving lots of stimuli. Everything you live, all films you watch, all books you read, conversations you overhear in the street, things that people tell you about, and all these stimuli create, they merge inside you. They constitute a mix of different things that you eventually use when you write. So when you start writing something, you somehow, sometimes unconsciously, use this mix. This mix goes out in the form of literature. Of course, you alter it, you distort it, because you want to benefit your work. So you can use things you've lived unconsciously, things you've got from books, things you've got from films, always at the service of literature, always at the service of the work you're writing. And also the thing of the fact of, you know, being or working in different fields. For example, now I'm teaching Catalan, for example, but I'm also a proofreader. I also run book clubs in Catalonia. So all these different jobs help me approach literature and also the language, the Catalan language, in different ways, from different perspectives. And all these perspectives help me write, because they constitute different ways of approaching the language and approaching the literature. So when I start writing, I feel that this diversity of stimuli and perspectives are very, very useful when I have to write. This is why sometimes I feel I wouldn't like just living off writing, because I really need to be doing other things, yeah, to have stimuli, because otherwise I would be like, you know, writing there and what can I write about? Because I need the real world, you know? So, yeah, it sounds strange, because lots of writers really want to live off
their work.
Yeah, this is the goal. This is the main goal for everyone writing, but not for me. Because as well, you'd be like forcing yourself to write. You have to pay the rent, right? So you need to write something.
It's nice to want to do it.
Yeah, right. And yeah, sometimes I have nothing to say and I don't write. I read, which also constitutes the writing part. Reading is part of writing as well. And watching films for me, cinema is very important for me when I write. So yeah, I wouldn't be able to just write in my life. However, the origin of La Grande Nausea, I feel it's a mix of a couple of things. The first one was a personal situation I was living. I really don't like to use my life in literature, because for me, a book is an autonomous artifact. It's not my life. So I really try to separate both things, but it's impossible, because you always end up using things you've lived. However, I was living like a very tough period of my life. It was a bit, well, an overwhelming, stressful period of my life. I was working in three different places. I was finishing my degree. I had to write my final dissertation, and I had published my two books, my two first books, the novel La Mort Lenta and the book of poems Provincia Cavall Negra. And it was incredibly overwhelming. So I could feel a feeling of weariness, a feeling of tiredness, a feeling of... It was a very weird period of my life, and I could feel this weariness, not inside me, but in the things that surrounded me. Things became meaningless all of a sudden. And I really took an interest in all these concepts, the tedium, the abulia, all these concepts, and I started reading about it a lot. This is something I really do when I write. I have an obsession, and everything I write, everything I watch, goes in that direction. Because I think, you know, if I'm writing about all these concepts, reading about them helps me go farther. So yeah, I read, for example, some very eye-opening authors like Byung-Chul Han, who's a South Korean philosopher I really like. He has this short book called The Burnout Society, in which he delves into these concepts as well of tiredness and how we exploit ourselves to be productive and to feel useful in a society with meanings that are already worn away, are wearing away. And I also read, for example, Peter Handke, who has also written about this feeling of tiredness. I read Lars Svensson, who has an essay on also this feeling of tedium. He's a Norwegian philosopher I really like. So yeah, I started reading about all these concepts, and I would say this is the main origin of the book. I really need to read about what I'm writing about to create an emotional landscape that will be useful when I start.
So you've got this kind of diversity of stimuli and this kind of need for... I look at way as well that your response to this period of difficulty and stress was to move to a different country and start a computer job in the middle of a global pandemic.
Yeah.
But, and, you know, not set foot in a classroom for over a year after starting the job. But, you know, that's another thing. So talking about this kind of diversity in stimuli and this diversity and potentially a diversity in form... something that is characteristic not only of this piece but of La Molenda and of, you know, previous work that you've done is this kind of blurring of the lines between poetry and prose. And when we sat down and decided what poems did we want to translate, what poems did we want to form part of this reading, it was clear that within the collection there are poems that are a lot more prose-like in nature, and this is something that harkens back to La Molenda, where you've got prose that is a lot more poetic in nature. So this kind of blurred line between poetry and prose that you kind of have a bit of a history of, what do you feel that you gain by playing with form in this kind of way?
Yeah, for me, the separation between genres is always blurry, and I like it to be blurry. I think there's not a clear, defined line between genres, and I like it to be this way, because I really like to play with genres and formats. So I consider the genre question more of a continuum, like a spectrum. Of course, you can place your work in one of both ends. You can do something very narrative, you can do something very poetic, but also you can play in the middle. And I really like to play in this middle area. When I'm writing poetry, I really like to, you know, also include elements that are traditionally linked to the narrative, but the other way around as well. When I'm writing narrative, I like to consider the resources that poetry gives us to, because they are benefiting the play, they are benefiting the work you're writing or the poem you're writing. I think you have to take them into account as well. However, this is not something new. For example, in Catalan literature, they did this in some Baroque authors did this already. They talked about the mixture of genres. So they did it back then. So it's not something new. But I think this genre ambiguity, it can be a resource for your works as well. You can play a lot with the composition, with the format. However, sometimes when I'm writing, I have the feeling that I am not who decides what shape or what format the work will take. Because you sometimes start writing a poem in verse, and suddenly you realize the poem is asking you to be in prose, and the other way around, you start writing a prose, and all of a sudden you see it should be a prose, or it should be something else. Also, when you're writing narrative, maybe you write some extracts and you think it might be a short story, and it keeps growing and growing. And
you have a novel.
And the other way around, maybe you think, oh, I have a novel here, or an idea for a novel. And then you see it's not enough for a novel, and it ends up being a short story. But I really like that it's the text that asks you for the shape it wants. It's like an idea didn't feel comfortable in a body, and it kind of asks you to give her another body or another shape, and I really like it. But yeah, as you were saying, when I, well, in La Gran Nausea there are lots of poetic proses, but there are also some texts that are very, very narrative. And also in La Morlenta, my novel, it's a very poetic novel, but I also included some pictures, for example, or lists. This can be literature as well. I mean, I try to take into account all the resources I have at my disposal, as long as they benefit the work. This is something I really have in mind.
So if we've talked about kind of fluidity and how you can kind of move between forms and how you can be led by the work itself to kind of, you know, see what form. Let's talk a bit about structure then. Mm. So we've talked about freedom and fluidity, but let's talk about kind of the way that this collection is kind of structured, right, around these kind of phases of vomit, if you like, these kind of different biological processes.
Doesn't sound very
Do you know what? We're in a very beautiful room to talk about a collection in a kind of vomit green,
yes,
about vomit. So, what? And much like the titular poem as well, the last one that we just that you just read, La Gran Nausea, the poem itself, is very clearly structured around these different biological phases. So, could you speak a bit to that kind of the way that this is a very structured collection around those points? Can you talk a bit about what that brings to everything?
Yeah, for me, when I write a book of poems, well, first I write the poems autonomously, and then I kind of see there's a narrative behind them, because they are related to the interests I have at that moment. So for me, the thing about the narrative is very important. Because sometimes we think, okay, we generally link the narrative to a novel or to a short story. But for me, a book of poems has to have a narrative as well. For me, a book of poems is not just a juxtaposition of poems with no relation to one another. For me, there has to be a discourse behind it. There is a progression. There is an evolution. And in La Gran Nausea, I think the premise is a collapse. It's a metaphorical collapse that is represented in the first prose with a collapse of a house in which you and an I are buried under the rubble, and then how they turn all this destruction into ruins. So they kind of give it an atavic aura, a romanticized aura. They mysticize the destruction. And then the last prose is the collapse of a whole city. So it's a circular book. And this collapse is the collapse of the meanings, the collapse of the senses. I've always had the feeling that humans have the need to attribute to all the things a meaning, to attribute all the things a sense, to make survival something meaningful, to make life something meaningful. However, when this is just the facade, when this facade collapses, the things are there. And their nakedness and meaninglessness, right? And can we really face this meaningless condition of the reality and of life? So this is something I really wanted to explore with this poems. This is why I took this symbol, the nausea, from Sartre, of course, but also Nietzsche talked a little bit about it in some of his works, as this feeling of existential discomfort towards this meaningless condition of the reality, and also towards the arbitrariness of the world. Things don't mean anything by themselves. It's humans who attribute everything meaning. And when we don't have these meanings, we have to face things in their pure condition. And this is something we really... I don't think we can stand this meaningless condition of life. So I used this symbol and I took it to the extreme. So it's not just a nausea, it's a great nausea. And also it's not just a nausea, it's even the vomit. So it's this biological reaction towards this interior malaise to this existential discomfort towards the absurd of life, of reality. So this is something you were saying now. In fact, it's a very physical, biological book. It's full of scientific terms and scientific concepts. And I really like to also play with this. I really like, I was talking earlier about mixing genres, but I really like also mixing tones and mixing different fields of knowledge, but also how I can just, you know, use scientific terms alongside metaphors and very visual poetic images. I think we can play with that as well in poetry, because I really think that anything can be turned into poetry. Why not? Also a vomit.
So this a book, thereof.
Yeah, with this color. So yeah, this biological reaction towards this weariness, and also this weariness, this feeling of tedium that we feel, I think that it leads to this void and this nothingness, because there's nothing there. Behind things devoid of meanings, there's the void.
So this, this leads us on to something that's going to be coming in the in the latter three poems that you are both going to read as well, this notion of a void, the void. And you've already talked about al rest, like nothingness in the first poem, but al void, the void, becomes something that is very present in your last in, as the collection kind of progresses. So of actually it's all through the collection, of course, because this is one thing that I wanted to ask you about with the void, is at the very beginning of the book, that you'll see later there are books for sale. At the very beginning of the book, there is like a cast of characters, right? And one, and basically it's me, the other, and the void there as like a character made tangible, kind of not necessarily made flesh, but made tangible. So could you talk a little bit about this kind of playing around with taking something that is ultimately intangible, like nothingness, a void, and making it into this kind of entity? Like, what does that kind of, what was the decision behind that? How does that go?
Yeah, actually, as you were saying, there's this dramatis personae at the beginning of the book, which is something you would normally expect in a theatre play, but not in a book of poems. But as I was saying, there's this narrative, and I realized that in this narrative there were three main clear characters: the I, or the self, the you, or the other, the otherness. Everything that is not I is other, or you. And then the void. The void is omnipresent. It's everywhere. I would say, like, in all poems, or most of them, the void appears, because it's the main character. And as you were saying, there's a process from this intangible void inside someone, this feeling of discomfort, this weariness, this feeling of nothingness, to a tangible, real void. So we kind of expel or get out this void out of ourselves, and then this void becomes something material, something real, something that at the end of the book devours a whole city. So it becomes an agent in the book, whereas the I and the you gradually become objects with no agency at all. So there's this process of this void becoming more and more agent, and this you and this I, who feel they can't do anything in front of this void devouring everything and becoming material and tangible. And I would say there's also another process in the book, which goes from the individual to the community. So it starts focusing a lot on the relationship between the I and the you, and how there's a miscommunication. They cannot communicate with each other to talk about this distraction, to talk about this nothingness. And gradually, we are going to this feeling of discomfort, this feeling of weariness will keep spreading to all the community. This is why we have the house in the first prose, and we have the city in the last prose. And this way I made the book circular, which is something I really wanted to do. Yeah, so I would say these are the two processes we have. And also this process of going from this intangible void to the tangible one is also a reflection of how the nausea becomes vomit. So this physical, intangible, abstract discomfort becomes something material, tangible, which is the vomit. This is why I structured the book in these three parts, repulsio, antiparisthalsi, and emesi, which are scientific words for the three phases of the vomit. This is why I structured the book this way.
So, moving away a little bit from the book and towards you, kind of like as my friend the author, like, you've touched on this already, but who were your influences?
As I was saying, I would say that everything that you live is an influence, and everything you read, even the bad books, are influences. Maybe more than good books sometimes, because it's like, I don't want to do this. So I would just run away from this. But yeah, as I was saying, everything I watch for me, for example, the cinema, is a major influence. Some filmmakers are crucial to me when I write. The way they create the images, the way they create narratives as well, and how they see the world, how they represent it. But of course, writers, and also, as I was saying, things that happen to me, things that happen to people I know, things you overhear, everything is an influence for me. Because I somehow use it, consciously or unconsciously, for the work I'm writing. However, I feel there are some transversal influences that I always have in mind when I write. But I also feel that every work you write, I think it requires specific models, depending on what you want to do. So for La Gran Nausea, I had ones in mind, as I was saying, Peter Handke, I had also Lars Svensson, Nietzsche, Byung-Chul Han. But for example, when I wrote La Mort Lenta, it was Hermann Hesse, for example, or other authors. When I wrote Renice Gran Negra, some others. So I would say, as I was saying, every work requires specific models. However, for example, I would say Mercè Rodoreda is one of my influences. She's a Catalan author, she was. She lived most of her life in exile because she fled Spain when Franco came to power. And she lived in France, she lived in Switzerland as well. And the first thing that really impressed me at first of Mercè Rodoreda was how she used the language. Because I think she does something that I really like when I write and read as well. She creates a feeling of strangeness towards the language, because she kind of places a word in a context in which you wouldn't normally expect it. And at some point you look at the word, and she makes you look at the word very closely, because you wouldn't expect the word there. And she plays a lot with this. She was a genius when it comes to generating this feeling of strangeness that I really needed for La Gran Nausea as well, because I wanted to create this feeling of strangeness as well in the reader, not only with reality, but also with the language itself. To look at the words closely, and all of a sudden the words seem strange. Because one of the reasons I write is that I have the feeling that we erode the language with its daily use. We every day use the words and the language, and we kind of erode the words and the language. And literature, for me, is giving value to words again. Make the words seem strange so that the reader looks at them closely. And yeah. So Rodoreda is very good at this, was very good at this. When I read her works, I'm still impressed, because you keep finding new meanings in words every time you read her. And a poet who's writing now in Catalonia, and I really like as well, is Maria Cabrera. She's a young poet, but she also has this skill, this ability to generate this feeling of strangeness. And also she has a book of poems called The Tired City, La Ciutat Cansada. And there, in that book, there's a similar narrative to the one in La Gran Nausea. And it's a model I've always had. But yeah, I've always had other models of Catalan literature, for example, Gabriel Ferrater, Joan Vinyoli, Silvi Rozkovic, for example, Jota de Foix. So there are lots of authors that I really look up to and that were real influences.
Also, I suppose you've mentioned a few, and this is going to be my last question before we kind of jump up to the floor. But obviously, we're in front of a diverse audience of some people are Catalan students, some people are from the Bristol Poetry Institute, some people are other contacts as well. So we don't necessarily have a kind of, between everyone in the room, might not all know what the current Catalan poetry scene is and what, you know, and what the current health of Catalan poetry is even. So how does this fit in with the current Catalan poetry scene, and yeah, what is the current state of Catalan poetry, if you like? You know, what would what might the Bristol Poetry Institute like to know more about Catalan poetry?
Yeah, I have mixed feelings about it, because there's a good thing, and something has happened in Catalan literature lately, which is very good. The first thing is that there has been a huge emergence of small independent publishing houses that are competing against the big traditional ones who used to monopolize the Catalan book market. And they are very special because they sell lots of books despite being very, very small. They publish like 10 books every year, so it's not much. But they have created a coherent catalog, and they have a very faithful readership because of this coherence. Some readers know that if they choose a book of this publishing house, they will like
it.
And also the publishers are very close to the readers. They participate in the events and they defend the books themselves.
Right.
This is why I decided to publish this book. This book has these virtues, these qualities, and it's them who defend the book. This is something that doesn't happen with the huge publishing houses, for example. And also something good that has happened as well is that bookshops have become cultural centers. So they are not just bookshops anymore. They create community. They put into contact readers, writers, translators, publishers, and librarians as well, booksellers. They do book clubs, they do poetry readings, they organize events all the time. So there is a huge vitality. There are lots of opportunities, lots of awards, grants, subsidies, festivals. So I would feel optimistic, because I think now Catalan literature is healthy. And a lot of people are writing as well. And as I was saying, lots of the opportunities. For example, we have like lots of awards. And some people sometimes joke, they say that we have more awards than people writing, and more people writing than people reading. So yeah, it's funny, but this is what kind of happens, and some people even complain about it. There shouldn't be so many awards, because then the quality of the works is lower. I will never complain, because there are too many awards. I mean, institutions... No, but I mean, you know, institutions are investing in literary works. It's better that this, and they invest in other things. We want to have more resources and more opportunities. So I'm optimistic, but at the same time, I think we shouldn't forget that Catalan is a minoritized language, and also that there are some limitations. Also because when it comes to readers in Catalonia, people who speak Catalan in Catalonia also speak Spanish, but not everyone who lives in Catalonia speaks Catalan, and this is a limitation for the market for Catalan books as well. So the numbers are low when it comes to the sellings, and however they are growing. So I want to be optimistic about it, and there's a vitality, and I like to see it, to be seeing it. There are lots of things being done, and I hope it will improve at some point.
Fantastic.
Now I'm going to read a poem called El buit o la traïció de la paraula escletxa. I va ser llavors quan et vaig veure un buit de dins la boca. Era un buit fet de la son d'un bosc immens d'arbres longeus. Era un buit fet del plor de mil ocells sobrevolant una ciutat sense memòria. Era un buit fet de la gent que mira amunt i diu que plou. Era un buit fet del mirar dels peixos morts. Era un buit fet de deserts plens de soroll, molt lluny del mar. I et mirava els ulls per no mirar-te més la boca, però la boca se't vessava i les genives se't desfeien i les dents t'eren de molsa i la llengua s'esclafava sota el pes de tant silenci i els llavis se t'omplien de clivelles que eren boques totes noves que tampoc no deien res. I va ser llavors quan et vaig mirar el buit de dins la boca. Era un buit ample i espès, del color d'una fi feta calma i amb la forma del mar quan va ple, i escumejaves de saburra com un animal trist i escopies viris negre i la llengua se t'alçava ben altiva com un pi i se t'enfonyava el paladar com un arrel. I et vaig notar l'alè, i el teu alè era fred, i el fred era molt lent.
The void, or the betrayal of the word crack. And it was then that I saw the void inside your mouth. It was a void made of the sleepiness of an immense forest of long-lived trees. It was a void made of the weeping of 1,000 birds flying over a city with no memory. It was a void made of the people looking up and saying, "It is raining." It was a void made of the gaze of dead fish. It was a void made of deserts full of noise far from the sea. And I looked at your eyes in order to not look at your mouth anymore, but your mouth overflowed and your gums melted and your teeth were made of moss and your tongue was squashed under the weight of so much silence and your lips filled with cracks that were new mouths that didn't say anything either. And it was then that I looked at the void inside your mouth. It was a wide and thick void with the color of an end made calm and with the shape of the sea when it's full. And you foamed with sabura like a sad animal, and you spat black bile, and your tongue stood upright, tall and proud like a pine tree, and squeezed through your palate like a root. And I felt your breath, and your breath was cold, and the cold was very slow.
Splint. El badall dels continents s'esllengueix com una son lenta. La tristesa de la llum se'ns dessagna sobre el cos amb nusos clars i transparents de letargia. Els anys tenen els ossos buits, el temps du el desert a dintre. La civilització és un santuari consagrat a l'apatia immersessible que arrossega tots els déus. Occident en sospira la melsa.
Spleen. The yawn of the continents languishes like a slow drowsiness. The sadness of the light bleeds all over our body with clear and transparent knots of lethargy. Years have empty bones. Time carries the desert within. Civilization is a sanctuary devoted to the unwilting apathy that gnaws at all gods. The West sighs in our spleen.
And the last one, Apocalipsi. Els peus inútils dels segles, fredíssims, caminant sobre les rajoles d'una sala d'espera. Les paraules exposades al perill de poder dir-les, el vertigen de les boques ran de mot. L'apocalipsi dels ulls mirant les coses i tu i jo enmig de tot, amb tanta nit ficada als ulls que ni la nit no vèiem. Res del món mereixia ser dit.
Apocalypse. The useless feet of the centuries, extremely cold, walking on the tiles of a waiting room. The words exposed to the danger of being said, the vertigo of the mouths beside the word. The apocalypse of eyes looking at things, and you and me in the middle of everything, with so much night in our eyes that not even the night could we see. Nothing in the world was worth being said.